is number 77074. Council, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and would you like to reserve any time?
I would like to reserve 3 minutes for my rebuttal.
Okay, very good.
Good morning again, Your Honors. My name is Jonathan Elson. Despite having called Nevada my home for many years, this is actually today my first time at the state's capitol. And despite having practiced for several years, this is my first time in front of this high court. Just trying to get here early, letting it all sit in, the honor and privilege that I know very few of my colleagues will get to share. But notwithstanding, as I've prepared for today, and as I've had the chance to speak to the appellant over the past weeks and coming, getting ready for today, and no disrespect to Your Honors, I wish I wasn't here. And I say that because if I wasn't here, that would have meant March 22nd, 2018, the 5th Judicial District Court would not have erred in terminating the rights of Mr. Lomax. It would have meant for the past 22 months, my client, the appellant, would have had the opportunity to be a part of his children's life, to buy Christmas presents, to call his children and wish them happy birthday. But sadly, I'm here today because on that fateful day in March 2018, the court, in following the lead of a multi-year concerted effort by the respondents, erred in terminating the parental rights of Mr. Lomax. And in doing so, it undermined what this court has found to be a fundamental liberty interest. In Re-JLN 118, Nevada 621, this court noted that the parent-child relationship is a fundamental liberty interest, and that the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment protects parents' fundamental rights to care for and control children. Further in that case, and this is big, the court found that the termination of parental rights is an exercise of awesome power, and such is tantamount to the imposition of a civil death penalty. And I argue before Your Honors today that back in March of 2018, the court erred, and in doing so, erroneously imposed such civil death penalty to Mr. Lomax, the appellant. We argue that the court initially erred in improperly joining the two cases of the respondents, literally the day of the hearing, the evidentiary hearing on the matter. We further argue that the court erred in its final order terminating the rights by referencing exhibits and pretrial memos not in the record and not set forth properly. We further argue that the court erred and abused its discretion in its entirety in how it handled the July 2016 stipulation order as between each respondent and Mr. Lomax. We believe that the court should have taken into account the timeliness in which the respondents acted and the fact that in failing to move timely, they waived their right to enforce it. We believe that the district court erred in not evaluating whether or not it was unconscionable as it was against public policy. And we also argue that the court erred in using that as the sole basis for finding of parental fault and parental unadjustment, as the gravity of these proceedings required that the district court should have gone on its own fact-finding and conclusions of fact. We further argue that the court erred in so much as giving any consideration or gravity to the testimony concerning alleged allegations of domestic battery incidences, as all of those incidences had occurred prior to the July 2016 stipulation and order, and in so much as reconsideration of that was barred by McMonagle and Castle. And we also believe that the court erred in using the valuation of best interest in following the NRS 125C0035 in determining it was the best interest for the children to have his rights terminated. Now, with regard to joinder, this is one where we believe there is a huge error made by the district court. Mr. Smith, in his answering brief, argues that the parties were put on notice February 26, 2018, that the parties were going to have their cases joined. However, I disagree with that in so much as on that day, the matters were heard on the standard district court stacked calendar. There were numerous cases called that day before the district court judge. And in fact, on the February date, there is no exhibits entered. There is no witnesses provided. In fact, all that was simply done was setting of the March hearing. And I would further argue that if Mr. Smith was so inclined to believe they were joined, he would have not continued to file exhibits and witness lists in each matter. Because if they had been joined, he would have filed in the joinder case number, similar to what we've done with this case before, Your Honors. Now, I understand Mr. Smith's argument, and it's right. You know, we need to show that there is prejudice. And I believe on its face, Mr. Lomax was prejudiced by the joinder. First and foremost, the record will reflect that a failure to timely file witnesses and exhibit lists by the respondent's trial counsel, Mr. Smith, resulted in an objection in the striking of all exhibits and witnesses. Meaning, if the cases had been bifurcated and heard separately, it would have been each respondent's testimony against that of Mr. Lomax, period. But by joining the cases, all of a sudden the advantage was given to the respondents, the moving part, the parties that had the burden of clear and convincing evidence. It's our further contention that in joining that, the court took away Mr. Lomax's right to invoke the exclusionary rule pursuant to NRS 50.155. Had the court heard the matter separately, yes, perhaps it would have been continued, and yes, perhaps Mr. Smith could have had each party testify on behalf of the other. But Mr. Lomax would have still had the right to exclude the witnesses from hearing the other's testimonies. But rather, on that fateful day in March 2018, both respondents got to sit and corroborate, listen to, and thereafter corroborate one another's testimony.
Did the joinder of these cases violate 128.0905 and 6, and if so, how?
As far as the exclusion of the parties from, yes, we believe it does, because that statute is to allow for parties it's to protect the interests of the children, and I believe to protect the due process rights of a parent whose parental rights are being sought to terminate. I think it goes along with NRS 150.155 in allowing for the exclusion of parties so that the testimony can be taken in, any party that's a witness can be taken independent of all the other parties without being able to corroborate. And that's how we believe it was a violation of that statute. Your Honors, further is our argument that the court erred in its order terminating Mr. Lomax's parental rights. As you recall, the hearing was March 22nd, and after several months of prodding, Mr. Smith finally provided an order to the district court, which was laced with references to exhibits and pretrial memos not in the record. Despite objections Mr. Smith and I made before in the judge's chambers, the court, in essence, copied and pasted Mr. Smith's order into their own. And the reference is critical here because, given the gravity of these proceedings, it is likely, more likely than other family proceedings, I would argue, that an appeal lies waiting. And so I would argue that the error of the court in not allowing the court to make its own findings of that absence of error, exhibits not on the record, is an error that the court made.
The parties did not submit trial transcripts as part of its appendices. How are we supposed to assess your assertions?
And Your Honor, I had filed a request for the transcript. My office paid for those to be submitted, so I'm not sure what occurred with that. Mr. Smith can certainly testify, he was trial counsel as well, that the exhibits were struck. I do not believe he even disputed that in his response. In fact, his argument is, well, they were references to
your duty as appellant to make sure that the transcripts are tendered to the court as appendices?
It actually is.
Both of your duties as a joint appendix?
You're right, and to the fact that that was an error, I apologize to Your Honors.
So I'm trying to understand why they were not submitted as joint appendices.
Well, the transcript
your question goes
to both of you, because it's supposed to be part of the, you're making this argument.
Sure.
But without the transcripts, we can't assess these issues or these claims on appeal. And while I understand your point about the fact that, at least I read the material, that there are discrepancies in the order and what was included in the trial and what was objected to and the like,
sure,
in the absence of the transcripts, we can't assess that.
And I apologize. I would argue that Mr. Smith did not dispute the fact that the exhibits were not entered into record, and makes reference that the only exhibits referenced in the order were previous stipulations and orders. But again, I don't think there's any dispute by the respondents' counsel that the exhibits were never properly entered into as exhibits. And in fact, based upon him filing the list of exhibits, they prior to the evidentiary hearing, they were struck by objection.
Here's the material question I'd like both counsel to address. I understand your arguments about the joinder issue and the problem there.
Correct.
But I think one of the questions that is present is the role of the stipulation in the court's decision. As you know, the order seems to recite the statutory subsections that would provide an analysis or satisfy a required analysis for termination of parental rights beyond the stipulation. I'm trying to understand why those separate findings aren't sufficient, even if we were to find that the stipulation is violative of the statute or is improper.
Well, we believe, and again, we, I appreciate your question, Your Honor. The separate findings that are very minimal outside of the stipulation order, I mean, the order terminating rights, in essence, more or less mirrored the stipulation order and all the violations alleged by Mr. Lomax. But, Your Honor, notwithstanding the variance outside of those and the small findings by the court, we believe those are largely based upon, again, the joinder issue, allowing witnesses to testify in corroboration against one another, but also the inclusion of those domestic battery incidences that occurred and were known to all parties, both respondents, prior to July 2016, we would argue should be barred by McMonagle and finding this court's holdings in McMonagle and Castle as far as parties knew about that. The only thing not on notice July of 2016 was the conviction stemming from an alleged violation between Mr. Lomax and his then-wife. But the parties were all knowledgeable and aware of such. In fact, that's why it was in the stipulation of if he had a conviction. But conviction or not, the parties were aware of the fact that, in fact,
You're saying the facts giving rise to the underlying incident occurred before the stipulation.
Correct. The only fact after the fact was a conviction. But mm-hmm. That was a conviction from an incident in 2015, of which the parties, the respondents, were acutely aware of. Mm-hmm. And so we believe those would be barred by McMonagle. And again, as far as the stipulation order, our argument would be the timeliness of which it was brought forth. The record will reflect that Mr. Lomax conceded a lot in that July 2016 visit stipulation order, but also gave a lot. Also, the respondents received a lot. In fact, they were allowed to supervise and grant visitation. July of November 17, after a year of unfruitful attempts to visit his children, he filed a motion, just a modified motion. And it was only in January of 2018, over 18 months later, despite the allegations and the violations and the stipulation order occurring in 2016, the respondents moved forward. And so the court, district court, I believe, erred in even considering any of those because of the timeliness of the parties. I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Okay.
Good morning, Your Honors, and I apologize for not being here timely. I had miscalendered the date, and so my apologies for that. Your Honors, I would like to start by answering some of the questions that were asked with regard to the violation of statute. We don't believe that there's been a violation of statute by having these matters heard together. The district court handled these handled that issue at the February 2018 hearing. He called both cases together and he set an evidentiary hearing for the parties together. At the evidentiary hearing, both parties were present. The appellant was present and the court heard objections as to why we shouldn't allow the trial to proceed as is. The court stated that it was going to do so on the basis of judicial economy. And so, because the court said that if we're going to do a termination of parental rights, he was going to decide the issue on both of the cases, not one. And even if he separated the cases out, he would hear both cases before making any decisions.
Let me ask you a question. What in 128.090 can you point to that really encourages or allows this?
The consolidation?
Yeah.
I don't know that it encourages it, Your Honor, but I think that the court's decisions over the years have been clear that the matter of whether or not the court permits a joinder is a basis of discretion, and the court's not going to overrule that discretion.
Well, isn't there a confidentiality issue here, too?
I guess, technically speaking, there may be a confidentiality issue, except that's the whole issue in this case, is there is no confidentiality issue. This is all based on the same parties, the same allegations of facts, the same underlying stipulation in order that would have permitted the termination of parental rights, the same abuse to the child that is being alleged by both parties.
And there's two children that weren't part of that abuse to that other child.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So why wouldn't there be confidentiality issues here that would preclude this to occur under 128.090? And you've got closed court sessions that are implicated. And what did the court find pursuant to that statute that the open hearing wouldn't be detrimental to the child?
It was clear to the court, based on the briefings, based on the arguments, that both parties already knew the underlying facts, Your Honor.
Did he make that finding in his order?
I didn't see the finding in the order, Your Honor.
And pursuant to 128.090 subsection 5, I don't see it in the order either. And is that a finding that you think is necessary?
I'm not going to interpret the statute for the court. I believe that the court's decision, the district court's decision, was the proper decision. There was no reason for two trials in this case. And realistically, and this gets to the second question that I wanted to answer, had the court had the transcripts here to review, what the court would have seen was that there was no overlap of testimony. There was no issues with regard to one party playing off the other party, no duplicative questions.
Well, let's approach this a separate way. How was the Bauer matter necessary to the Martinez matter and vice versa?
The child in the Bauer matter was present during the abuse of the appellant's third wife, and in fact came home with unexplained bruises from that same incident and child pornography on his telephone from that same visit. And it is based on those allegations that these petitions for termination were brought forward, not just those, but all the underlying facts of the case that had proceeded before that. The parties are close. The children are close. So this was the Bauer child that was implicated, but I don't believe what the court's asking is that, or saying is that the Bauer child should be protected, but the Martinez children should not. The Martinez children were not present at the time, but they could have been present at the time.
Occurred involving the Martinez children after the stipulation. What set of facts occurred after the stipulation was entered into that threatened, created harm to, posed a threat to, or an issue under the termination of parental rights statutes to the Martinez children?
Dad was harassing mom during the visitations and implicating the relationship between mom and the children. So mom was permitting supervised visitation between dad and the children, and dad was making a mockery of those visitations, offering different activities for the children to do, and when mom would deny those activities because she wasn't prepared for those, dad would then mock mom and make the children cry in her presence. This is harassment. This isn't what was supposed to be done.
We don't have any transcripts that show that. And what you just related is not contained in the findings of the court regarding the Martinez children.
I believe the harassment is referenced in the findings of the court, Your Honor. And again, with regard to the transcript, I'll get
post the post-stipulation?
Post-stipulation, yes, Your Honor. Post-stipulation. That would be in the best interest analysis that the court provided, Your Honor.
Is harassment one of the factors you consider under the parental fault statute?
It's one of the, it's something I think that could very well be considered in the best interest statute, Your Honor. So parental fault, I don't know that harassment is in there, although I don't know why it wouldn't be if the harassment was severe enough. Stalking, domestic violence, harassment are all issues that can cause a separation of a parent and a child at a TPO court and an extended protective order beyond that. So the fact that if it got extreme that the court couldn't use that as a basis doesn't strike true. With regard to the transcript, Your Honor, getting back to that issue, there is no requirement, although I believe there's a preference for a joint appendix. I was not approached about providing a joint appendix. I did see the appendix that was put forth by appellant's counsel. I did call appellant's counsel and note to him, I need a copy of the transcript. I don't have a copy of the transcript. The transcript itself is referenced in the appellant's brief, page numbers and verse citations, but I didn't get a copy, and when I asked for one, he said he wasn't permitted to produce those to anyone else, that he'd had problems in the past and was very leery about giving those out. And so
leery about giving what?
Very leery about giving out the transcript. Now, that's a rule of the Supreme Court, but it is not. What was that?
Did you go to the court reporter to get a copy?
I didn't. I was told I'd be charged the full price for the transcript. My clients didn't have the money to pay for that. Quite frankly, that's not my client's obligation, is to incur that fee. This court's review of the brief indicates that if the transcript is not present, this court's findings in other cases have stated that the transcript is not present, that supports that the district court's decision was correct. And so that certainly isn't my client's responsibility to go out and find that transcript. That's an express duty of appellant's counsel.
Well, are you arguing in part that the court made its own independent findings based on evidence and not just based on the stipulation?
Yes, Your Honor. Those findings are found in the order.
Okay. And those findings would have to be supported by the evidence, right?
Well, the findings would have to be supported by the evidence. I think they were supported by the evidence, but there's a couple of, and I guess I'm not sure which stipulation you're referring to. Is it the stipulation in order that was signed by the parties, which led to the filing of this termination, or was it the stipulation in court that the parties went in and said, we hereby stipulate that this satisfies the parental fault?
When did that happen?
That happened at the beginning of the case.
Before 2016?
No, or at trial.
At trial, parties agreed.
The parties' counsel met and came up with a stipulation that said that Dad had essentially committed the acts that were found in the stipulated agreement between the parties, and that would be sufficient to meet the parental fault prong. The court specifically allowed time for that negotiation. We came back and put that on the record, Your Honor.
So your position is Mr. Lomax, through his counsel, stipulated that he had done things that would satisfy the parental fault prong.
Yes, Your Honor. Explicitly at trial.
Okay. As to that, so now I am talking about the 2016 written stipulation and order, where, you know, there's this writing that talks about if he does certain things, that would be considered sufficient. If those items wouldn't qualify under the statutory factors, then can the parties agree that something would be parental fault if it wouldn't otherwise be so?
It's a very interesting question, and I don't know that that's the actual thing here, but I think what the court's real question is, and there's got to be a distinction here. We terminate parental rights all the time. It's done every day. It's done with a piece of paper that says, I hereby consent to a termination of my parental rights. I hereby consent to an adoption. Sign, witness, done.
Right.
There's no buts about it.
Yeah.
And so what this court, the question this court can answer is, may parties enter into an agreement whereby they say, look, if I don't meet certain grounds, I'm willing to terminate my parental rights. I don't see any distinction between the two issues, especially if those parties are represented by counsel. The order is run by a court, the district court, and the district court signs off on that. I don't know why that wouldn't qualify as a valid agreement to terminate parental rights. In fact, it is a form of a parenting agreement, and this court enforces parenting agreements. It encourages it. It's public policy that we enter into parenting agreements.
So, but at the time this TPR proceeding was initiated, Mr. Lomax apparently at that time did not stipulate to terminate his parental rights.
We initiated the TPR and he had not stipulated to terminate his parental rights. We closed the case pursuant to a stipulation in order.
Right, no.
And then reopened, yes.
Okay, so what I'm talking about is, okay, so now, so that agreement was entered into and then subsequently there was reinitiation of these proceedings.
Correct.
By the mothers.
Correct.
Okay, and they brought these proceedings. At that time, did Mr. Lomax agree, yes, you can terminate my parental rights?
That particular stipulation in order was already an order of the court, but when we got to trial, the court had the attorneys go negotiate and see if indeed Mr. Lomax had violated the terms of the agreement and if that would equate to a finding of a parental fault. And the attorneys stipulated in open court that it would.
That it would be parental fault.
Yes, Your Honor. And I believe findings were made in addition to that, but that was part
and
of
so it. Was the idea that all that was left was best interest of the child analysis?
Yes, but that was the court's intent. But as the court knows, these two prongs are tightly interwoven.
Right.
You don't necessarily get to the one without getting to the other.
But there was a trial after this purported agreement was entered. So the court must have thought there was something left to try.
Well, the stipulation specifically talked about parental fault. It didn't talk about best interests. And so the court indicated that it would permit that type of a stipulation. It did permit it. But then the full trial went on. We didn't skip part of the trial because that stipulation had been entered. But we were focusing specifically on the best interest factors.
And sorry to go back to this again,
sure.
But is there anything in the record that would show us this agreement that you've talked about?
What there is the order of the court and the subsequent
right.
order.
Does the order reference that the parties agreed to that?
Yes.
Okay, I would
have
to look at that.
The court wants me to, but I wouldn't.
Okay, I have the order as well.
Okay, so it references that in the orders terminating the parental rights, but it also references that in the order from the motion for reconsideration that was filed by appellant. So these issues have all been litigated multiple times. The objections have all been raised. The district courts considered them multiple times. And we would ask that the court uphold those findings of the judge. Any other questions, Your Honors?
Time's up.
Not for me. Justice Hardesty, anything else?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just a few points. First off, I think it's quite important to go back to the court's position that the termination of parental rights is, again, an exercise of awesome power. And the gravity of such is to...
Counsel, with your time remaining, yeah. Counsel made an assertion that you entered into a stipulation at the commencement of the trial that Dad's actions since the 2016 stipulation and order were violative of the stipulation and order and were sufficient to meet the parental fault prong of the court's inquiry. I'm reading from page 6 of the order, lines 10 through 14, which references in footnote 4 a pretrial memo, a video, and video portions of the video record.
Yes.
Is that the stipulation you entered into?
It's not that my recollection, Your Honor, in a review of the facts. It was the party, Mr. Lomax, through myself as counsel, stipulated that, yes, the court could consider those because, in fact, the July 2016 stipulation order says may, and that is an opportune word there, that the court may consider these subsequent violations of the stipulation order as an admission and may consider those admissions in the termination. But, Your Honor, I'd point to that same page of the order, page 6, where the court finds that MOM's analysis regarding the party's contract is adopted. And I bring the court's attention to that because in contract law, there's a thing called waiver. Your Honor pointed out earlier in questioning Mr.
What
Smith about the
contract is being discussed at lines 20 through 22. MOM's analysis regarding the party's contract is adopted. What contract are we talking about?
Mr. Smith in the court was referencing the contract a la the July 2016 stipulation order. And again, that goes back to if the court wanted to adopt that, the court needed to evaluate the timeliness in which the respondents brought their action. Again, the record will show Mr. Lomax was not abusing or harassing. He was trying to exercise visitation and brought a motion in November of 2017 to modify visitation, only to be met with this petition to terminate rights. Sorry, I went over. Any more questions, Your Honor?
I think that'll do it.
Thank you.
Okay, counsel, thank you, and we will take this matter under advisement. It stands submitted, and the court will be at recess until the next call of the court.